Oh, let's see, we're going to be reading from this web link which I will send. From Science Daily. It's an article on what is called the God particle. Abhidrai Prabhu asked me to say something about this article. Very interesting piece of news recently has come. May, the end of May. Titled The Large Hadron Collider. Enables hunt for God particle to complete the theory of everything. Maybe you've heard about this. Can everyone see that page? Huh? Vada Prasad Prabhu, can you get that page? No, the other page that I sent. All Science Daily. Did you get that link? You have to look for that link on that orange button again, or that I don't know if you have the window open. I'll send it again. All right, we'll send it again. Do you see it? Huh? Okay. All right. You can click that link. And there's Science Daily about a large Hadron Collider enables the hunt for the God particle to complete the theory of everything. So that this is big news in the science community. They have built one. Billions of dollars they have spent in making this large underground magnetic field, giant magnetic cylinder, in which they will try to create high impact particles. Particles that are moving at very high speed, so that when they collide together, they will explode and produce many subparticles. So, for instance, when two neutrons collide with each other at very high speed, at high energy impact, they split into smaller subatomic particles. They're called subatomic particles or quarks. Then sometimes this collection of subatomic particles are called hadrons. Hadrons means a collection of subatomic particles, usually quarks. Quarks are smaller than a neutron. Protons, neutrons are made up of quarks, and electrons and things like that, they are not made up of anything smaller, because they're already very small. There's only so much you can do in getting to smaller and smaller particles. It's not that it's limitless. According to science, they have to stop at a certain point. Why? Because just like an electron is a very small particle, very, very small, very light. I don't remember the weight of the electron, but it's very small. And it occupies a very small space. if we think of it as a particle. Some people think of it as a wave. Depends on how you are estimating it. It can be both. From the theory of quantum mechanics, it's just a vector in a different type of space, not even space-time. It's called Hilbert space. Hilbert space is not a physical space, it's a mathematical space of infinite dimensions. Functional space. Doesn't have a space-time coordinate frame, but it's infinite space. And electron is considered particle in that space, or some kind of vector. It would not be proper to call it a particle, but more proper to call it a vector in that space. It has certain dimensions in that Hilbert space. That's all you can say about it from the quantum mechanical point of view. From the classical point of view, we talk of particles and waves. But from the quantum mechanical formulation, we can only talk about vectors from the mathematical, strictly mathematical point of view. Anyhow, that vector can be analyzed into any smaller parts because of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. The uncertainty principle says that you can only locate a particle within a certain small distance, small space. If you try to shrink this space and try to define the position of that particle very minutely, then you will expand the momentum unlimitedly. Momentum has to do with how fast the particle is moving, and how fast the particle is moving has to do with how much energy the particle has. So by increasing or decreasing in the location of that particle to very, very small space, you increase the momentum unlimitedly. And that means that the electron already occupying a very tiny space, having a very small energy, mass. If we tried to find a subatomic particle of the electron, we'd have to get to a smaller space than even what the electron already occupies. The result of trying to reduce the electron down to something smaller, with occupying a smaller space than the electron itself, would mean that we would increase the momentum or the mass of the electron beyond what it is already measured to be. So a subatomic particle, it means of an electron, would have to be way more than the electron itself. So that's impossible. That would be an impossible situation. So therefore, electron is assumed to have to be an elementary particle. It doesn't have any smaller, it can't have any smaller mass than it already has. Because if you try to measure such a thing, if you ever try to experimentally verify such a smaller particle than the electron, you would run into a paradox of having a particle, a subatomic particle of the electron, that would be more, way more than the electron itself, by Heisenberg's principle. Anyhow, but proton and neutron and particles like that, they can be made up of smaller particles. They're called quarks. And in general, these composite particles, atomic particles, or the subatomic particles, the subatomic components of the atomic particles, such as neutrons, protons, and other names, very fancy names they have for all these things, they are called hadrons, collection of quarks. And so this collider is meant to allow those two neutrons, for instance, like I said, colliding, allow them to emit their subatomic particles and to measure them. They have ways of measuring the particles once they come out from the neutron collision. And they don't measure the particles directly, but they measure tracks that are produced by the particles and are captured on a special film that can see those tracks. And then they try to determine what produced those tracks, what type of particle must be there to produce those tracks, how many particles there must be involved, all those things they can calculate just by seeing that film. Anyhow, there's one particle, one special particle they haven't been able to find yet, because it's a very heavy particle. And it comes out of a particular theory that was developed by a man named Higgs. I don't remember his first name. And they call it the Higgs boson, or the what they call the God particle. And I think this article explains what is that about. So when the world's most powerful subatomic particle collider begins gathering data this summer, it will be a major milestone for a number of University of Washington scientists. The UW, University of Washington, led by Professors Henry Labate in physics and Colin Daly in mechanical engineering, played a central role in designing and fabricating the nearly 90,000 tubes that are key to the workings of the ATLAS detector. ATLAS is one of six particle physics experiments that are part of the Large Hadron Collider at the European Organization for Nuclear Research, known as CERN, C-E-R-N, near Geneva, Switzerland. Physicists the world over are hoping that ATLAS will help unlock some deep scientific mysteries and perhaps even lead to discovery of the Higgs boson, sometimes called the God particle, because it is believed its discovery will refine the understanding of exactly how the universe came to be and how it functions, and how mass came to be in the first place. University of Washington researchers are primarily involved with an ATLAS subsystem that detects subatomic particles called muons. These particles have little interaction with each other or with other matter, and are formed as a byproduct of the collisions between protons and nuclei of hydrogen atoms. The collider will provide far too much data for scientists to log all of it. So the first appearance of muons can be a sign that scientists need to record information on collisions taking place at that time. They are like little messengers that tell us a potentially interesting event may have occurred, a signal that we should look more closely at that event, Lubati said. Potentially, that could lead to direct evidence of the elusive Higgs boson. That's just one example of the detector's value, Lubati added. There are many other interactions that produce high energy muons, so it is very important to be able to observe these. The scientists are looking for other information that will help them to fill gaps in what they call the standard model of particle physics, a framework that explains the fundamental forces of nature. The standard model explains the way particle interactions create the strong nuclear force, the electroweak force, and electromagnetism, and how those forces work with each other. But aspects of those interactions are still not well understood. The Large Hadron Collider also could lead to better understanding of the fourth fundamental force, gravity, in terms of particle interactions, and help solve the puzzle of why gravity, while perhaps the most recognizable to lay observer, is the weakest of the fundamental forces. The collider is a successor of sorts to the superconducting supercollider, a high-energy collider that was to have been built in Texas. The supercollider was first proposed in 83 and construction began in 91, but escalating cost estimates and other factors created controversy, and Congress canceled the project in 1993 after about $2 billion had been spent. University of Washington scientists, including Lubati, who initially worked on the superconducting supercollider, began working on aspects of the Large Hadron Collider in the mid-1990s. The collider, which is to begin test operations in late May or early June, will send hydrogen protons racing at nearly the speed of light in opposite directions through parallel underground cylinders that form a large circle about 16.5 miles in circumference, straddling the Swiss-French border. The cylinders intersect at various points, allowing proton collisions that produce subatomic particles that can be observed by one of six detectors, each positioned at one end of the intersections. The Atlas detector contains more than 430 chambers filled with aluminum tubes that range in length from about 5 to 10 feet each, resembling a fluorescent light tube. From the early 2000s to 2007, some 30,000 of these tubes were made at the University of Washington and fitted into 80 chambers that were then packed into cargo containers and shipped to Geneva. That cost about $50,000 to ship each chamber, and all arrived undamaged. Another 60,000 tubes made with the University of Washington methods and specifications were packed into chambers at two other U.S. sites. Once in Geneva, the chambers were mounted into 32 sections shaped like giant pie wedges, which fit together into two rings at either end of the main detector. The last segment of the world's largest general-purpose particle detector was lowered into place on Leap Day this year. The tubes critical to the detector's work have a skin just 1/64 of an inch thick. Each has a gold-plated tungsten wire just half the width of a human hair strung tautly through the center that will detect what happens when subatomic particles collide at nearly the speed of light. The manufacture required great precision, in some cases with tolerances of less than 1/1000th of an inch. A tall order for instrument makers and machinists in the University of Washington Physics Department. A major part of their success was designing and making the equipment that could replicate such precision. Threading the tiny wires was another great challenge. Maintaining that kind of precision can be very difficult when you're working on scales of more than 9 feet. But we were able to do it, Daly says. We found that students with good eyes were able to thread the wires very easily. If I tried to do it, I couldn't even see the wire. The other institutions that worked in the manufacture of tubes for Atlas using techniques and specifications developed at the University of Washington are the University of Michigan, California, Irvine, Brookhaven, National Laboratory, Boston, Muon Consortium, including Harvard University, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Tufts, Boston, and Brandeis Universities. In addition to Lobati, other University of Washington physicists, participants included Professors Tianqi Zhou and Paul Muckett, who retired in 2005, and staff members David Forbush, Joshua Wang, and Matt Tomey. Participants from mechanical engineering are Daly and Lab engineer, William Kuykendall. So, anyhow, it doesn't give much information here. Basically, I explained the idea of what the collider is doing. I mentioned neutrons, but of course, because this is using a magnetic cylinders, they need a charged particle. So they use proton instead of neutron. Proton is also made up of quarks, just like neutrons. And so they use protons. They have a charge, and it can be have a magnetic charge. Then they can be used. So much noise is coming from your microphone, Akshayapu. So because they have charge, they can be used by the magnetic field of the collider to accelerate. And this 16 and a half mile cylindrical accelerator can bring, that means that can bring that proton up to close to the speed of light, moving at the speed of light. So certainly when that particle collides, that proton collides with another proton, it will produce a massive amount of energy. Massive amount of energy will be applied to that particle, to those two protons. And that kind of energy is needed to produce this this Higgs boson, or God particle, because the Higgs boson has a massive energy, something like 200 billion electron volts is the mass of the Higgs boson. Maybe less than that, but they're expecting maybe not more than that. If the Higgs boson is more than that, they can't measure it. There's a limit to what science can do. They can't measure a particle that's heavier than about 200 to 250 billion electron volts. And there's no energy field they can produce that would be strong enough to make that type of energy production, mass production. So if the universe happens to be made of particles that are heavier than the Higgs boson, then there's no way they can ever determine that. This is the limit of scientific endeavor. However, if it's less than that, they may be able to measure it. And then according to this, the theory developed by Higgs, once that particle is discovered, as he predicted, then he has written one theory which describes how this particle, or the field that it creates actually, and it's interesting, the field of the Higgs boson is like the ether. What has been already dismissed by Einstein's experiments for the existence of the ether as now being introduced by Higgs in the form of this Higgs boson. The Higgs boson is not only a particle, but every particle has its own field. So this field of the Higgs boson is a very important one, because it is by his calculation, according to the existence of this field, all the particles, all the subatomic particles from the standard model of physics will get their mass. Mass of the particles, subatomic particles, comes from the interaction of those particles with the Higgs boson field. Someone described it as the quarks are a little heavier than electrons. So when a man walks through the mud with boots on, he picks up a lot of mud on his boots, and so the boots become heavier due to the mud. Same way the quarks, when they pass through the Higgs boson field, because they are a little bit larger, they collect a lot of mass. Electrons have small shoes, small feet. So when they pass through the mud of the Higgs boson field, they only pick up a little mass. And photons, they don't even have any mass at all. They're like, they just fly over the mud. They don't even touch the mud. They don't even touch the Higgs boson field. Therefore, they are massless. Photons have no mass. Photons means light particles. So quarks, electrons, photons, like that, all elementary particles can't be reduced. They don't. So they, anyhow, they are, and this way they can, this field can be used to explain the different masses of the various types of particles. So that's why they call it the God particle. If this field is there, then they can explain how the masses of the different particles come about. Otherwise, at present, they have a panoply of different subatomic particles of various masses. They have no idea how this particle zoo, they call it, even the science physicists call it a particle zoo, because it's merely a conglomeration of different weights of particles that really don't have any relationship. They don't see any systematic relationship among all those different things, why they should have all those different weights and various properties that they have. Simply a conglomerate of various evidences that they have picked up with no synthesizing or systematizing theory to back that up. So science is not simply about collecting various pieces of data. If that data can't be organized by some theory, then it is pretty much, you know, just a cataloging experience. Science becomes just cataloging different experiences. That becomes a boring job after very soon. And it's not useful for anything. Only when they have a theory, then they can make something out of it. So Higgs has come up with this theory based on the Higgs boson that will explain how the different masses, in a systematic way, how the different masses of the particles come about and how they can be organized into a scheme or a system. So that's why it is such an important particle. Not only does it give mass to the particles, but it also explains, gives an explanation of why those different particles are there and how they all fit together. Well, of course, there are so many problems that one can see even in that system, even if it works, even if they find that particle. Now, the main big problem is that theories of particles are inherently defective, in that they can, the theory of particles, any theory that involves particles or atoms, are inherently defective in that they can't explain continuous phenomena. Particles means discontinuous. Quantum means discontinuous phenomena. So how do you explain continuous phenomena like gravity? So Higgs, the God particle, will help to formulate what's called the standard model of physics. Standard model of physics means what will explain electromagnetic forces, weak forces, and strong forces. There are four types of forces in the universe, according to the scientists. Electromagnetic, strong, weak, and gravitational. So this theory will only explain three of those forces because it's a particular theory. It has difficulty working with gravitational. And according to Einstein, the standard model will explain, because it explains electromagnetic theory, it can also incorporate quantum mechanics and quantum electrodynamics and special relativity theory, but it can't accommodate general relativity theory. General relativity theory has to do with gravity, mean? General relativity means it has to do with accelerating systems. Gravity is a force of acceleration. When acceleration means when something is moving, the movement is increasing with time. It's moving at 10 miles, then 11, 12, 13, 14, like that. It keeps moving faster and faster. That's called acceleration. Special relativity deals with systems that are moving at a constant velocity. And if a car is going at 10 miles an hour, it keeps going at 10. It doesn't go any faster or slower. Relativity has to do with, general relativity has to do with what happens when a system starts accelerating. You start from zero and you go on faster and faster and faster to higher and higher speeds. That's called accelerating system. And to make measurements in that system requires general theory of relativity to work. So the standard model that the Higgs boson is supposed to apply to only includes special relativity, quantum mechanics. So it can never be a theory of everything because it can't explain gravity. Can't explain general relativity. Doesn't work for that type of system. So how much they are giving the name God particle to this, how much it can actually explain about the theory of everything, that's very questionable. And if they don't find this particle, either that means it's heavier than what they assume it is, in which they can't measure it anyhow. Oh, already they built this 17 mile collider. Some people say 5 billion, some people say 10 billion. Nobody knows how much they spent, and they are not giving out that figure so readily. Who knows? Maybe 20 million. I don't know how much they spent in that. If people knew how much they were spending on that collider, they would become infuriated. Because there are so many things going on in the world. People are starving and whatnot that are not being taken care of. And they are spending on this machine to measure some esoteric particles. That they're even. And how much will they continue on in this way? Finding more and more particles. And there's a limit to that also. As I tried to explain, theoretically, there's a limit. Anyhow, that's what they are doing. And where is that money coming from? Most likely from people who are working very hard, paying taxes or whatever. And it's being spent in projects like that. What's that? Huh? Dark matter? I don't think they know what that is yet. So I'd be able to explain what they don't know is there. They know that there are some... Actually, I doubt they will be able to explain that because dark matter arises from the fact that there's not enough gravity in the universe according to the amount of matter that's there. So it seems to be connected with the theory of gravity more than with the theory of atomic forces. And like I said, the theory of gravity is not accommodated by this standard model of physics. Can't be accommodated. So I don't think they can find that. Of course, if they accept that there is some kind of an ether that is filling the universe, then they may have to change all of their theories. Because presently, they're going on the assumption that there is no ether. If you add an ether, a particular field, to the universe, then all their theories will have to be changed, and all these paradoxes may evaporate. dark matter, dark energy, all that stuff may just evaporate because it's coming out merely from a particular quirk in the mathematics, the way the system is set up. In that case, dark matter will simply disappear. But they haven't come up with a theory of the universe that includes the ether yet. Or maybe they have, but it hasn't become popularized. Yes, the Higgs boson. Higgs boson has a certain field associated with it. Every particle has a field associated with it. So the field of the Higgs boson is some purely mathematical field. It's not an electromagnetic field. It's not a field of weak force or strong force. Rather, it gives substance to those forces. So what that is only mathematical construct, something very subtle. But they have to predict that is there. If anything is to be there, then they must predict that field is there also. So I was thinking that this Higgs boson field gives mass to the different particles. But what is mass? Anyone can say what mass is? When you talk of mass, when the physicists talk of mass, what do they mean? Into a larger particle. That's something like that is also true. That mass means the measure or the amount, quantity of matter, right? If there's a big quantity of matter, then there's a big mass. Small quantity of matter, small mass. So mass basically means matter. All right? Matter. Quantity of matter, that's another thing, but matter is the basic meaning of mass. All right, now, what is matter? What is matter? What are the scientists? What do we mean when we say matter? No, that's mass. That's mass. In Newton's laws, we find mass. But I'm saying, what is matter? How do we define matter? Yes. Matter is what has sensible, can be detected sensibly. Can be detected somehow, can be experienced by us, by human beings. What can be experienced by us we call matter. Bhagavad Gita explains earth, water, fire, air, ether. Earth means smell, odor. Earth, what has odor is called earth. Water, a taste. Fire can be seen. Air can be touched. There's a sensation of touch. And ether, sound. So anything that falls within those five categories is matter. But then they also explain mind, intelligence, and ego is also matter. And of course, scientists don't know about that. but they can also be experienced, so they are also matter. We can experience that we have a mind making decisions. We have intelligence to make discriminations. So these things within experience are called matter. So the idea of the quantity of matter is a little bit more difficult, but it means basically density, I think, or how much, if you're accumulating a lot of matter, just like Akshay Prabhu said, accumulating more and more bits of matter, that would be one idea of quantity of matter, or density, that there's many, many particles are packed into. That will also give us an idea of quantity of matter or mass. So think of these things a little bit metaphysically from point of view of Bhagavad Gita. To give mass to something, if the Higgs boson is giving mass or matter to something, what does that mean? It is giving it more quantitative measurement potency, potential, to be experienced more strongly, or to give some stronger effect at the experiential level than other things. Some are stronger, some are weaker. Just like electron has a very weak effect, weak mass, low mass, and some of these other particles have big mass, stronger effect. No. Has nothing to do with space. There's a different principle. There's a different principle. As a mathematical concept, as I explained, the Higgs field has to be understood within a mathematical space, Hilbert space or something like that, vector space, can't be understood within the space-time framework. I think we lost. So it can't be understood within the space-time framework. It has to be understood within the functional space of mathematics, Hilbert space, something like that, of quantum mechanics. Anyhow, these are the kinds of questions that we have to deal with, that we have to try to incorporate into our Krishna conscious philosophy. How we can use our philosophy, a Bhagavad Gita philosophy, to tie in with this work that the scientists are doing, and try to convince them that this and the God particle is not the Higgs boson, but something far more complex than that, more personal, more weighty, we can say. Can't be measured because its weight is so great. Just like if this Higgs boson weighs more than 200 billion electron volts, or 250 electron volt, million electron volts, then they can't measure it. So God is the most, is the infinite. He can weigh more than all of those things put together. He is heavier than all of them. Then how they can measure that? How they can measure the infinite? It won't be possible for them. Yet that does not eliminate it. Because we can't measure it, because we can't experience, it does not mean that it is not there. So God, although immeasurable, is there. And he is giving that most, the most immeasurable of all masses, both the heaviest and the lightest of all masses, he is there, and he is giving the foundation, providing the foundation for all experience. After all, what is experience? Experience means there must be consciousness. Without the consciousness, the experience means nothing. There is no experience. So experience requires consciousness, and that consciousness comes from Krishna. The Supreme Personality, the Supreme Consciousness, produces the consciousness which allows the experience to be possible. So more fundamental the experience than the experience, wider than the experience is Krishna. And like that, we have to understand and we have to explain that this limited experiments they are doing, these limited concepts they are coming up with, even after billions and billions of dollars, you can't spend enough money to understand God. And you don't even have to spend any money. Just use a little intelligence, and automatically we can understand these things without so much expenditure of money on useless things. Working hard simply to develop all this useless knowledge that doesn't arrive at the final conclusion anyhow. Something like that, I think we have to argue. What's that? But it can be detected, can be measured. They say they can measure it, and it gives experimentally confirmed. It can be experimentally confirmed. It gives experiments that you can perform to confirm its validity, as what they say. Just like everything is a theory, it's a model. Everything is a model, and it can be. And the predictions of that model have certain consequences from the experiential level. So if those experiences, if those predictions are verified by experience, then they say their theory is correct. Their theory explains the phenomenon. But they don't talk about the limitations of that just like they don't talk about the limitations of that it's not able to explain gravity, and so many other paradoxes will arise. It will not be able to explain. So many other particles will come out that they won't be able to explain, and they will simply ignore those for the time being and say that we have a working model that's generally correct, and everyone will say, oh, how great they are. And they're not able to explain mind or consciousness or intelligence or persons or love or anything like that. Still, they will proclaim, now we have the theory of everything. And people will bow down to them, oh, you are so wonderful. What's that? They are. They are. All experiences matter. And according to Gita, mind, intelligence, ego is also matter. Whatever is within our experience, that's matter. Who is experiencing that? That is something else. That is consciousness, that is spirit. Consciousness. We can also be conscious of consciousness. That's called the self. I. But that is not an experience in the same way. It is the experiencer. It is the experiencer. And spiritual life can also be experienced, but that's a different type of experience. It's not an outside experience. Experience from the outside and experience from the inside are two different things. That kind of experience of the transcendental nature is of a different type. And then the experiences of the mind. Then we shouldn't try to use the mind to understand the spiritual experience either. Spiritual experience can only come when you give up the mind, actually. When you allow the higher realm to come down, not by your calculation, not by your knowledge, but by His sweetness, by His grace, by His love. It comes down to envelop us and take us to that world. People are so anxious for knowledge. But there is a world where knowledge is not meaningful and not important as much as love is. When the mother gives the sweet ball to the child, if the child asks, what is this made of? How did you do this? What ingredients you put in it? Did you make it in clean did you make it in clean environment? Did you use the proper ingredients, organic, or did you use chemically fertilized? What did you put in it? Then a mother will feel disappointed. I can't answer all your questions, my child. I don't know all these things, but only always may I made this for you, and I thought you would like that so much, and you are simply asking, like in suspicious way, what is this, what is that? All rasa will be spoiled. The whole taste of that relationship will be spoiled. So like something like that. Spiritual life is not based upon all this calculation. It will be spoiled. You will lose it. You will lose that spiritual taste if you try to bring knowledge there to that plane. Of course, it is not sentiment either. It must be understood in the proper way. It is not mundane love. Mundane love, when there is some opposing tendency, then mundane love is immediately stopped. Oh, you had like that? I don't love you anymore. Spiritual love. That's ahoitakiya pratiyata. Nothing can stop it. Uninterruptible. And like that, to understand what that is and to understand what is mundane love, that's also very important. Anyhow, we are practitioners of the transcendental love, love of God, eternal, infinite love. That comes by surrender and service. But if the people of this world are unwilling to give themselves that type of experience, to know what that kind of experience is, that's based upon sacrifice. They are unwilling to taste the nectar of that kind of experience, that kind of life, of spiritual life. And then how to convince them to give up their enjoying type of life, exploitive type of life, and enter into the dedicative, sacrificing type of experience, and to find with that the joy that lies there. How to convince them to do that, and give up all their knowledge seeking, simply surrender and serve. How to convince them to do that, that is our job. Prabhu's mission, and we are trying to serve that. All right, I think it's very late now. We had better stop. Thank you very much. Yes, any other? Right. So this is what we're trying to do. Yes, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to take from the scientific point of view and explain things in a systematic way. We have to use reason to show that there is something beyond reason. It's not impossible, just like I'm explaining to you all. That not that we are the king, not that we are the lord over all of reality. There are certain limitations we have, and that can be understood rationally. That's only common sense. And it can also be understood by making all these deep investigations, that there are certain limits to which we reach. Just like people were previously, they were thinking, oh, we know electron, we know proton, we know neutron. Now we have all knowledge. Huh? They never understood. They never could imagine that beyond those simple particles, there were so many particles, dozens and dozens of more particles, elementary particles, subatomic particles that yet had to be discovered. Okay? And now they have so many particles, it's a zoo. The scientists call it a zoo. So many particles is like a jungle. And they are become all confused and disheartened. What can we do with this jungle? It is too massive for us to penetrate and to bring some order to that. Anyhow, they keep trying. Let them. Okay. Jai, O glorious to Srila Prabhupada. Gaura Bhakti Vindiki Jai. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ki jai. Jai. All glories to the assembled devotees. Hari Bol. All right, I'm going to end now. Hari Bol.